So here is the Washingtonians getting started in 1840 from six old drunks sitting around a tavern in Baltimore, and it started doing it just kind of for laughs, just to have a joke like drunks will do when you put something together in a tavern. And it mushroomed into this overwhelming society that thrived for some time, and their whole approach to alcoholism or to drunkenness was to encourage. I mean, it was a very spiritual thing they sort of evolved. Encourage people, to help people, to feed and to clothe. I mean, those are the fundamentals of spirituality, to house, to feed, and to clothe. And that's what they did. They even had a sort of a Al-Anon thing sort of get started, and they were really doing well, and they sobered up a lot of drunks. And they did it by one alcoholic sharing with another. They had what we call today, not exactly discussion meetings, but it was, meetings where you go and people get up to the podium and share their experience, strength, and hope. They tell their story. And they did really well. They didn't last. Take a break. You guys want to take a break? 10, 15 minutes?
So you got your paper back there?
Yeah.
We have a statement in our big book that says we are not a glum lot. And so I have a couple of things that are totally and completely off the subject, have nothing to do with anything except I think they're funny and cute. So I'm going to read them to you, a couple of them, just to kind of get everybody back into the spirit of things here. This is the absolute worst things to say to a police officer. Sorry, officer, I didn't realize my radar detector wasn't plugged in. Hey, I thought you had to be in relatively good physical condition to be a police officer. I was going to be a cop, but I decided to finish high school instead. You're not going to check the trunk, are you? Gee, is that a 9mm? Well, that's nothing compared to my 44 Magnum. Aren't you the guy from the Village People? there's one about something about donuts. It was really good. I don't see it right now. Anyway, that's one. I also have some more I'll give you later on as we go on. One is the man's guide to female English. No, I'll do it now. It says, we need means I want. We need to talk means I need to complain. I'm not upset means, of course I'm upset, you moron. You're certainly attentive tonight means, is sex all you ever think about? This kitchen is so inconvenient means, I want a new house. Do you love me? Means I'm about to ask for something very expensive. How much do you love me? Means I did something today you're really not going to like. You have to learn to communicate. Means just agree with me. We've had one request for a copy of this prayer, so I would like to leave it with somebody that would be willing to make copies for everybody and that wants it, and rather than just, is that okay, John? Okay, great. Going back to the thing, there was another movement that got started around the turn of the century called the Emmanuel Movement. It was started by a guy named Elwood Wooster up in New England, and he was a pretty hard-nosed religious guy, and this was pretty much a religious-based program. And I just mentioned him very briefly on the way by because he had some success in that area with getting drunk sober. Didn't last long, but it was a movement that got started and did okay for a while in a local area. The big group that got started, though, that we probably owe more to directly right now than any other group was the Oxford Group. You guys heard of the Oxford Group? There was a guy named, let me start by saying that the Oxford Group is given a lot of direct credit for having been a dramatic resource for Alcoholics Anonymous in our early days. And it got started back around a little after the turn of the century, back around 1913, I think, 1908, by a guy named Frank Buckman. And Frank was pretty much the head of the Oxford Group for as long as it lasted. He was a very young man then, and he had a religious or some sort of a spiritual transformation. And he got this group started, and it started mostly in Europe. And the Oxford Group mainly was a religious organization that essentially believed, I hate to generalize them too much, but they essentially believed in first century Christianity. That is one Christian working with another. And they believed, perhaps you've heard of the four absolutes, they believed in those very much, and that was part of their belief, their philosophy, and they gave a lot of that to Alcoholics Anonymous. And the Oxford Group is given a lot of credit by Bill Wilson for having given us, in essence, the 12 steps of AA. AA Comes of Age on page 39, Bill wrote, "Early AA got its ideas of self-examination, acknowledgement of character defects, restitution for harm done, and working with others straight from the Oxford Groups and directly from Sam Shoemaker, former leader in America, and nowhere else." And they played, as I said, a very significant part in our life. They practiced absolute surrender. They believed in guidance by the Holy Spirit, sharing, bringing about true fellowship. Certainly a big part of Alcoholics Anonymous, sharing. Life-changing faith and prayer. They aim for absolute standards, and these are the four absolutes I mentioned, of love, purity, honesty, and unselfishness. And if you've ever read anything about the early AA program, particularly in the Akron area, you know that those they believe very strongly in the four absolutes. And the Oxford Group carried the message aggressively to other people. They formed what they called business teams that would go around and do that. And it is absolutely astonishing how intertwined AA and the Oxford Group really were. Back in the early 30s, there was a guy named Roland Hazard. Roland was a bad drunk. He came from a wealthy family, had a lot of money, but he was a tough drunk. His family loved him, and they were willing to do anything they could to help him. And he had the wherewithal to go anywhere. He had a family, a wealthy family that could support any kind of recovery he could possibly find. And it was not a problem. Money wasn't a problem, in other words. And Roland went to Europe, and he spent about a year working with Dr. Carl Jung. Jung was working personally with him. And Jung and Freud were, along with Adler and a few others, were, in effect, developed a whole contemporary science or process of psychotherapy. I mean, these guys wrote a book on psychotherapy. Their methods are still used today. And so after about a year of working with Dr. Jung said, "You know, Roland, you might as well go on home. You know, there's not anything I can do for you. You're out, you're drinking. I don't know of any technique or any method, anything we've tried has not worked. You might as well go home. He said, the only thing I have ever seen that has any impact at all on the kind of alcoholic that you are is that occasionally I have seen people have a spiritual awakening or some kind of a religious experience, and it was just spontaneous. I have no idea how to induce one. It was just one that was just spontaneous, and they were able to stop drinking as a result of that experience. So my only recommendation is that you go home and see if you can find some sort of religious group to get hooked up with, and maybe that'll happen to you. It is very profound to me that what Alcoholics Anonymous has discovered and what we have in our program as clearly and explicitly stated in our 12th step, which says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result, not a result, but the result of these steps, which means Alcoholics Anonymous has come across a way, has been shown, has been given a way to predictably and reliably and repeatedly have a spiritual awakening, to cause a spiritual awakening in people. It's happened to all of us because we're all sitting here sober. They didn't know how to do it then, so they advised Roland to go home and see if he could find some kind of religious organization to get hooked up with, and maybe, just maybe, he would have some kind of spontaneous spiritual or religious experience that would change his life. And he came back and he got hooked up with the Oxford group and got sober. And they met, the Oxford group were kind of like AA in a way, in the sense that they met around here and there. They met in churches and universities and, you know, wherever they could find a place. And there was a guy named Ebbie Thatcher that came along who was a bad drunk. And Ebbie got hooked up with the Oxford group. And Roland Hazard was kind of like Ebbie's sponsor in the Oxford group. And it was Ebbie Thatcher then who later visited Bill Wilson in Towns Hospital. Actually, Bill heard about his old buddy Ebbie had somehow gotten sober, got hooked up with some religious people somewhere and had gotten sober. And Bill Wilson and Ebbie Thatcher were boyhood friends. They'd been friends all along. And Bill went to the Oxford group, and they arranged for Bill to get into Towns Hospital. And while he was there, Ebbie Thatcher came to visit him in the hospital, his old buddy, and this chronic drunk, and carried a message of the Oxford group to Bill Wilson. And that was in December of that year. And in one of Bill's AA talks, he said these are, and when he's describing the steps, he said the steps that they got, are the precepts or the concepts that they got from the Oxford group were this, and this is an actual transcription from one of Bill's talks. We admitted we were licked. We got honest with ourselves. We talked it over with another person. We made amends to those we had harmed. We tried to carry this message to others with no thought of reward, and we prayed to whatever God we thought there was. So here is Bill Wilson. There's a guy named Jim Newton who came along, and he played an enormous role in Alcoholics Anonymous. Didn't even know it. I don't think he probably died never knowing what he had ever done. Which is a nice way God works. You know, sometimes you just get to be one of God's miracles. You don't even know about it. You don't even need to know about it. You just need to show up. Jim Newton, he went to an Oxford group meeting looking for girls, hoping to meet a young lady. And he was 20 years old. And, you know, that we still have that going on today, you know. I mean, so if you've come here trolling, You're welcome in Alcoholics Anonymous. You need to know that the odds are good, but the goods are odd. Jim went to this meeting looking for some little honey to ease his burden, and he ran into Sam Shoemaker. Frank Buckman is the guy that brought Sam Shoemaker in. If you've read any part of AA history, you know that Sam Shoemaker played a very significant role in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. He was an Episcopal priest, or minister, but he was first and foremost a member of the Oxford group. Anyway, Jim was transformed. He had a talk with Sam, and he was transformed. And later on, a few years later, Jim moved down to Florida, and he and his father bought a lot across the street from Thomas Edison. No big deal, just a lot, and they bought it. But as a result of living across the street, they got to know Thomas Edison. And Jim was really taken with Mr. Edison, and Tom liked Jim. And Jim sort of became sort of like an adopted son to Thomas Edison. And they had these big birthday parties every year for Thomas Edison. And Jim got to be the MC, or the master of ceremonies, for these different social events, and especially the birthday parties they'd have for Thomas Edison. And people came from all over the country to help old Tom celebrate his birthday. He was a very well-known, well-liked man. And some of the people who came were the Fords from Detroit came to his birthday party. But a guy named Harvey Firestone came to those parties all the time. And Harvey was from Akron, Ohio. While in Florida, attending Thomas Edison's birthday party one year, he talked to Jim. He had known Jim now for a few years. And he said, "Jim, why don't you come up and help me run my company, which is Firestone Tire and Rubber?" And he offered Jim a very good position running Firestone Tire and Rubber, and Jim took him up on it. And he moved to Akron and began to do that. About 11 years went by, and Jim was doing very well. Firestone was doing very well. But Harvey had a son named Bud, and Bud turned into an alcoholic. They had to do something about Bud because he was not doing well at all. And they found a place in New York. It was a treatment center that, it's kind of like a drying out sanitarium because that's all they had then. But Jim Newton went to that treatment center and stayed with Bud Firestone the whole 30 days he was there, and taught him the concepts. In addition to what he got at the sanitarium, he taught him about the Oxford group and their movement. And Bud got sober, and he stayed sober for a long time. Later on, Frank Buckman, the founder, the originator of the Oxford group, Frank Buckman and 30 members of the Oxford group were invited to Akron to have a sort of a revival meeting. They didn't have revivals then, but they were invited to Akron to have a big sort of a convention or a conference and a kind of a revival meeting. And the only reason Harvey Firestone brought them there and paid for everything was because he appreciated what they had done through Jim Newton for his son Bud in helping him to get and stay sober for a while. So they came to town. And the Oxford group formed a strong foothold in Akron. And members of that group gradually became three very significant people. There are a lot of people you may have heard about if you've studied any of this history, but T. Henry and Clarice Williams were members of this group. But the three significant key people that I want to talk about today were a lady named Henrietta Seiberling, a lady named Ann Smith, was married to a prominent drunken physician, and a lady and a minister by the name of Tunk. And they were trying to get Dr. Bob, Ann's husband, to come to the Oxford group. And he would attend meetings but he never would open up. I mean, it's a big room. He's a physician in a relatively confined community, and what will the community think of him if they find out that the guy that's about to remove your hemorrhoids is a drunk? So, anyway, Henrietta Cyberling and Ann Smith were good friends and members of the Oxford group. And they were set up a small meeting of just a few people, and they finally got Dr. Bob to open up and admit that he had a real drinking problem, that he was an alcoholic. But they couldn't do anything about it. He just couldn't stop drinking. So, along about 1935, the New York stockbroker came to town, the rum hound, as he referred to himself. He had some business misadventures. He came here to Akron on a kind of a hustle. It didn't work out very well for him. His trip was a failure. And the Oxford group frequently met in Akron in a place called Mayfair Hotel. And that trip, Bill was staying in the Mayfair Hotel. And he was sitting there one night after his business deal had fallen through. He was morose. He was sad. He was just, you know, he was not having a good night at all. His whole trip was a failure. There were people in the bar right there. There was laughter, the clinking of ice, a lot of good booze. Somebody was playing the piano. And he thought, what the hell? You know, he had been sober at that time about 6 months. And he thought, what the hell? This is all a joke. See, and that's the danger spot for alcoholics. The minute we ever get to the point where we say, what's the use? We're dead. And we say, what the hell? It's not working anyway. If we ever get to that point, we're dead. And Bill was at that point. And as a last desperate measure, he saw a registry of ministers hanging on the wall that hotels used to have all the time. And the name on that list that he called was a minister named Tunk. He said, I need to talk to a drunk. Do you know any? And Reverend Tunk says, I do. And it was Reverend Tunk, a member of the Oxford group, who called his friend Henrietta Cyberling, who was a member of the Oxford group, who put him in touch with Ann Smith and Dr. Bob, who were members of the Oxford group. So you can see what an incredible impact the Oxford group had on the very core of Alcoholics Anonymous. Ebbie Thatcher brought the message of the Oxford group to Bill. Or, if you believe as I do, God working through Ebbie Thatcher paid a little visit to Bill. And just to get it done, working through the Oxford group, Bill was led directly to Dr. Bob, all through an Oxford group connection from New York City and Akron, Ohio, coming at it from both ways. So we have an astonishing debt to pay to the Oxford group. You know where they are today? They're gone. The Oxford group no longer exists. The Washingtonians are gone. The Emmanuelites are gone. Everybody that I've talked about this morning, they're all gone. What happened to the Oxford group is both simple and complicated. Frank Buckman just got a little too much press and became a little too famous. And in his megalomania, he decided that if he could transform the world leaders, he could alter world history. If he could somehow transform Adolf Hitler, I mean, he really thought these things. If he could somehow transform Adolf Hitler, he could transform the history of the world. The world's leaders were the ones that he needed to convert to Christianity, to his way of thinking. And so he decided to start with the Duke of Wales, And the Duke said, I don't think so. Didn't have any interest. So, you know, I mean, the Oxford Group was a very powerful organization. They had a big convention at the Hollywood Bowl in 1937. They had 27,000 members of the Oxford Group in the Hollywood Bowl and another 10,000 outside wanting to get in after it was sold out. I mean, this is a big deal. But because of the fact that they just got a little too grand and they forgot what they were all about, they no longer exist. They just couldn't keep it going. So, why did they fail? Well, they failed because they did not have a core set of traditions or values that allowed them to stay together. They just didn't. And so, that leads us right into the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we're going to go through those and review those very quickly, and then we're going to break for lunch, and then we're going to come back, and Polly and I are going to tell you how we use these traditions in our marriage. And, you know, because it's not exactly straightforward, you know. I mean, if you read the tradition, you think, well, what? You know, how is that going? How am I going to apply that to my marriage? And we have been shown how to do that. We didn't invent all this stuff. You know, we're just like you. We showed up and we didn't know anything. You know, a couple of snarling alcoholics. And we found people that were doing better than we were and said, how'd you do it? And they were kind enough to show us. So, you know, it's not like we're plowing any great new philosophy here, or that we're about to share some great new philosophy that we've invented. We're just passing on what was so freely given to us. So let's review them very quick. Tradition number one says our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Very simply, that means if we don't hang together, we're going to die alone. Number two says for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. This means, very simply, that no AA member can require any other AA member to do anything. Period. There are no people around here who are given, who are endowed with godlike qualities of leadership. This gives some of our more controlling members a little difficulty. In California, where I go to meetings, seat saving is a big deal. I'm sorry to report to you. And every time, annually, in my group, and in most of the groups I've ever belonged to in Southern California, we have what's called a steering committee meeting. And that means we're going to conduct the business of the group. We're going to elect a new secretary and a new treasurer and all the jobs. New people are elected to fill those jobs, and we take up any business issues that might come before the gathering. And seat saving is one that comes up often. How many seats you can save is a biggie, because we have people who like to come in and save half the room and then give them away as a means of controlling others. You know, we had one old guy named Holiday Kent, and Holiday Kent would show up to make coffees, so he got there before anybody, and he saved, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 seats, and he would surround himself with all the cute girls who would get there and didn't have a seat. And he was a nice guy. He wasn't fondling anybody or getting inappropriate. He just liked that. It's like all the pretty girls always had a seat in the meeting that Ken made coffee for them. we have in our group a policy that you can save 4 seats max. I sponsor a guy, or used to, and he just couldn't stand it. He would watch people. He's the kind of guy that would stand 8 items or less, cash only, and count your items and make sure you didn't have your checkbook out. And if you did, he would go crazy. So he would count seats. And it didn't take much for him. After the fourth card went down, if there's another card coming, you know, his thermometer begins to rise. And he would go crazy. And one day I said, Gil, you know, give it up. He said, well, but we have... I said, I know, Gil. Give it up. He said, how many meetings, how many steering committee meetings have you and I been to? How many times have we had policies and groups that we belong to and go to, rules that say 2 seats or 4 seats, and how many times have you ever seen anybody even bother to inquire as to what whether or not there's a rule? They always just do what they want to do. And you have to let them, because the alternative is to have seat police. And this is Alcoholics Anonymous. We have a tradition that says we don't govern. We don't have anybody here that governs. Don't drive yourself crazy with this. Just give it up. Don't worry about it. So anytime you have something like a seat-saving policy, that's one of those suggestions. Remember, Alcoholics Anonymous has suggestions, not hidebound rules. We don't have seat police. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Period. And if you are a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, if you say you are, if you say, I have a desire to stop drinking, and you want to be a member, you don't have to be a member, but if you want to be, you are. Back in the mid-40s, this is a funny story. In the mid-40s, the people in New York were trying to find out what is going on out there in the country. I mean, we're 10 years old, and what's happening with all these groups? We don't know anything about anything. So they sent out a letter to all the groups that they knew about, and they said, if your group has any requirements for membership, would you please make a list of them and send them to us? So they got all the replies from that response, and they put together a composite list of requirements for membership in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they looked at the list, and they said, Jesus, our judgment is no better than it's ever been. Look at this. You know, we haven't improved a damn bit. Look at this. You know, if we apply this list of requirements to our new members, our founders are not eligible for membership. They don't meet the requirements. And this was before we had traditions. And one of the reasons we have this particular tradition is because our judgment stinks. I hate that, but it does. Number 4, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Do you know if you call central office and say, I went to this meeting last night in Podunk, Ohio, and they let some overeater get up and talk? New York is going to say, so? You know, it's okay with AA if overeaters talk at AA meetings? Or gamblers? Or non-affiliated spouses of members? Or Al-Anons? It's all right with New York. It's all right with AA. If it's all right with your open meeting group, if that's your group's conscience on that, it's okay with AA. Every group is autonomous. Now, I may not want to personally go to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting that allows people in OA to talk. You know, nothing against OA. I don't mind that at all. I think it's a great program. But I'm an alcoholic, and I don't identify with people who have eating disorders when it comes to my addictive behavior, you know, my compulsive, obsessive behavior. But it's okay with AA if that's what your group wants to do. Isn't that great? Chips and birthdays and what qualifies one for a birthday cake. We argue about these all the time. You can search the AA literature throughout. There's no mention of chips and birthdays and birthday cakes. These are inventions of local groups, and they're great. You know, I think it's great. If your group likes to give birthday cakes to its members when they have an anniversary in Alcoholics Anonymous, I think it's great. But a lot of groups don't give that stuff, and they don't want to, and they don't have to. And if we don't like it, go find another group. What you do when you get mad in Alcoholics Anonymous? You get a resentment, just to buy a coffee pot and go find a church basement that's not in use on Tuesday night. Start your own meeting. They'll run you out of there after a while if you get to. Each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. We offer nothing else. We don't make loans here. We don't do job counseling. We don't do marriage counseling. We don't have any, we don't support or endorse any sober living homes or hospitals or educational institutions or any of that stuff. All we do is help drunks get sober. That's it. We have no other interest. An AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. That once again, that's all we do is sober up drunks. That's our whole purpose in life. That's all we do. We do that well, and we don't do anything else. And the only way we have ever found to avoid problems with money, property, and prestige is simply not to have them. If we have any money or property, we will argue over it. And if you don't believe that, go to some business meetings sometimes and listen to them. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. That seems pretty straightforward. So, a place in California, Ventura County, and an old man named Walter King was in the entertainment business. Walter's dead now. He was in the entertainment business, and he retired from showbiz, and he was in the film industry, and he went out to Ventura. He was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He went out to Ventura, and they didn't have a central office out there, so he just started one. And over the course of time, Walter used a lot of his own money for the affairs of Alcoholics Anonymous Central Office in Ventura County. He kept very careful records. His intent was that he would be paid back, you know, whenever the group was financially healthy and could pay him back, he would be paid back. Well, as Walter grew older and more and more people moved to Ventura County, they wanted to participate in the affairs of AA in Ventura County, and Walter didn't have much enthusiasm for that at all. He liked running it his way. So they're trying to figure out how the hell they're going to pay Walter off so they can get rid of him. Because, you know, it's hard to kick him out when they owe him all this money. So they decided they're going to have some fundraisers, and I owe him about $3,000. You know, we're not talking about the national debt here, but they decided they would have some fundraisers, and they were going to have a dance. And they were going to sell tickets. Now, for some reason or another, the Elks Lodge in Oxnard, California, which is in Ventura County, just loves AA. They have a big AA breakfast meeting there on Sunday morning and all that stuff. So the Elks Lodge says, oh, we'd like to donate $1,000. Well, that's pretty clear cut. Can't do that. We're self-supporting through our own contributions, and so you just can't do that. I mean, you know, thank you very much, and we really appreciate your interest and all, but we can't accept your money. So the Elks Lodge says, well, this is a public event, right? I mean, it's not an AA event. I said, yeah. I said, well, and you're selling tickets, right? Said, yeah. I said, well, give us $1,000 worth of tickets. Well, you can imagine what happened to that group of alcoholics, right? I'm at this meeting, and because I was a group secretary at that time, I had to go to this business meeting where this is going to be discussed. And I watch good sober members, like this room. You know, it's like you just split it right down the middle. You know, and this side over here is screaming and yelling, and they have called to and written New York, and New York says it's absolutely not okay to accept that money, sell those tickets to those people and all that, bang, bang, bang. And the other group on the other side is screaming just as loud and just as vociferously that, by God, they called New York and wrote to New York, and New York said it was okay to accept the money and all that. See, and they're both full of crap because New York doesn't tell you what to do. When you call them, they say, it has been our experience that, and they lay out the options as they see them, and you make your own decision. It's your group. You decide. So, self-supporting to our own contributions is a wonderful idea. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. People don't quarrel with that one very much, in my experience. Number 9 is AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. And this is very important. If you look at an organization, what do you have? If you look at an organization description, it's called an org chart. And at the top you have a box, and the leader's name is in the box. And under him you have a second tier of leaders. And all their activities are bounded. You know, if you are the manager of finance, all you do is get involved in the financial affairs and so forth. And once you are in that box of, you know, as the manager of financial affairs, then you want to name the tune that everybody has to dance to when it comes to financial affairs. So we just found out that we just can't be organized. We just can't. However, we do need some committees. We do have some things we have to accomplish. We have to produce literature. We have to have pamphlets and other kinds of literature. We have to have a big book. Now, and if we don't have some kind of committee or something that is directly responsible to those they serve, we don't have any way of conducting the business of Alcoholics Anonymous other than just simply going to meetings. Now, I don't know how it is in any of your groups, but it has sort of been a tradition in some of the groups that I have been a member of that GSR, the General Service Representative, is some thankless job that you foist off on some newcomer. You know, it's a 2-year commitment. Nobody wants it. You dump it on some newcomer. You groan audibly if that whoever it is ever tries to make a report in front of your group. You're like, oh, no. Well, my group, I am proud to say, and this is rare in my experience, but my group, I am proud to say, takes the GSR person very seriously, careful about who we elect. We insist that they come back to us after they go to these GSR meetings and tell us what happened. We don't want a long, elaborate report, but we want to know what's going on. And we want to know what's being mentioned. And we respectfully listen to that person. And I'm very pleased with that. And I'll tell you why. There have been a lot of harebrained ideas that have come along recently. One of them is, the big book is out of date. It's poorly written, and it has a lot of old ideas, and blah blah blah. And we need to fix it. And there have been other ideas that we need to rewrite it to make it gender neutral. You know what that means? That means politically correct. And all this. Well, the way you find out about things like this is because it gets discussed in a GSR meeting. Because New York goes through that channel to find out what people want to do about things like this. And the way you find out about them is you let your GSR come back and report to you that this is what they want to do. They are right now working on yet another edition of the Big Book. One of the things they started off wanting to do with it was make it gender neutral. And our group firmly said, no, you leave those 164 pages alone. However, we don't object if you want to change some of the stories in the back and then create another volume composed of all the stories from the first 3 editions. And you want to put some more stories in there, more contemporary stories? Great. Don't have any problem with that. Because we believe that the people, that the delegates that we elect and send back to New York will make sure that, you know, we don't get any goofy stories in there and all that. They'll argue over that. I mean, it's going to be 10 years anyway. You know how long it's going to take them to decide which stories. But that's how you find out about that kind of stuff and all this other stuff that, you know. I mean, maybe you don't think it's silly to have to rewrite the big book so that it's gender neutral. I mean, you know, just because I do doesn't mean you will. Maybe you would like to have that, but nobody's ever going to know that unless you go through the process of listening to your GSR and taking that stuff kind of seriously. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Since the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. We have really broad respect in the world because we mind our own business and we stick to what we do. We are trusted in the world. And we truly have no hidden agenda. We really don't. We just sober up drunks. That's all we do. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. I have very well thought out and distinct feelings about this tradition. I am about as anonymous as a freight train when it comes to Alcoholics Anonymous and meetings thereof. I always give my last name. It's not an accident, and I'm not showing off. I want you to know what it is, and I'll tell you why. One of these days, You may remember some guy named Dave. He lived in Cyprus, California, and I'm in Cyprus, and I'd like to know where a meeting is. But all I know is his last name was P something. So you can't look in the phone book and you can't call information. And if you're in my town and you want to find AA, I want you to call me so I can tell you where there's some good meetings that even take you to one. So Polly and I are in the phone book. It's Dave and Polly Pistol, and we always use our last names. Not at the level of press, radio, TV, and films, but always in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't want to be anonymous to you guys. You know, and the reason we're anonymous at the level of press, radio, TV, and films, everybody knows that, you know. So when we're on the David Letterman show, say, you know, I used to be bad, now I'm wonderful, I joined AA, and 2 weeks later we're drunk. Makes AA look bad. We're sorry about you, pal, but you make AA look bad. So, it's real easy to go from being an AA member to an AA show-off. And that's what anonymity at the level of press, radio, TV, and films is all about. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. And that's our reminder that every last one of us in this room, I'll tell you something I really believe, every last one of us in this room is doing the very best job they can with their life, with their sobriety. And I believe that with all my heart. You know, and the old man from Laguna, Chuck Chamberlain, Polly and I had the pleasure of knowing him. He used to say, if they knew better, they'd do better. And I believe that with all my heart. And so this is just a reminder that each one of us is doing the best that we can. And that love and tolerance is our code. Our book says that. Love and tolerance is our code. And it lets me remember that screaming in anger at one of my brothers or sisters in Alcoholics Anonymous or my wife, I may not be doing God's will for me. God's will for me may not be screaming in anger at one of his kids. He may have something else that he'd rather I be doing. And so this tradition reminds me that I do to watch what I'm about. And the tolerance, love and tolerance, is the code we live by in Alcoholics Anonymous. All are welcome. And so we're going to stop now, break for lunch. And then we'll go, after lunch, we'll go through the traditions one at a time. Polly and I will alternate on the traditions, and we'll talk about how we've managed to use the ideas that are in those to our marriage. Yes, ma'am. Oh, they finally had to turn it down? Yeah, well, what was it? A thinly disguised attempt to donate $1,000 to AA. We appreciated it very much. You know, I mean, their heart was in the right place. They were genuinely just trying to help us. But, you know, and they didn't understand. See, and it has to be okay that people don't understand about AA. We're not very understandable because the kinds of things that cause us to be so successful are not things that the rest of the world does. You know, the rest of the world believes you have got to be organized. You know, what do you mean anybody can just walk in and join? Now, what do you mean nobody's in charge? So, they don't understand. And the Onslaughts, they didn't really understand, but they said, okay, great, well. And we came out, you know, they really admired us for having the courage and the conviction to stand up and say, we really appreciate your offer, but we just can't accept it.
So what time do you want to leave?
What time do you guys want to come back from lunch? Want to come back at 1?
I think
you just said 1
o'clock.
Okay. Try it with me. Okay. Okie doke. Now, before you go, I'm going to give you real quick. This is the Women's Guide to Men's English. Okay? I'm hungry means I'm hungry. I'm sleepy means I'm sleepy. You want to go to a movie means I'd eventually like to have sex with you. Can I take you out to dinner means I'd eventually like to have sex with you. Can I call you sometime means I'd eventually like to have sex with you. May I have this dance means I'd eventually like to have sex with you. Nice dress means nice cleavage. What's wrong means I don't see why you're making such a big deal out of this. What's wrong means what meaningless self-inflicted psychological trauma are you going through now? What's wrong means I guess sex tonight's out of the question, huh? See it once. Okay, as promised this afternoon, Polly and I are going to alternate between the two of us going through the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and how we have tried to capture the ideas and the concepts in these traditions and apply them to our marriage. And I'll repeat something that I said yesterday. I got to tell you about my fortune cookie first before I do that. It says, "Your judgment is a little off at this time." My judgment has been a little off for a long time. we want to go through those because, you know, I know how it was when, and I remember where I was when I first heard somebody say, "Well, we use the traditions in our marriage or in our relationship." And I thought, what does that mean? And, you know, I mean, it wasn't real clear to me just how you do that or what that really means. And so we set about, not specifically to answer that question, but we set about trying to learn how to make our marriage work. See, Polly is not my first wife. I know you're all amazed to hear that. As a matter of fact, she is my fourth. And as one of our Al-Anon friends like to point out, my first three marriages were just dismal failures. I mean, there's just nothing else you can say about them. They were just dismal failures. They just didn't work. They never worked. And as my Al-Anon friend Carol Thornton likes to point out to me, I was the only common thread in all three. So, you know, I went through my life looking for Mrs. Right, looking for the right lady, you know, trying to find the right person for me. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and what you taught me was the trick is not to find the right person. The trick is to be the right person. And so, you know, if you think about that, try to imagine who your Mr. or Miss Wonderful may be. You know, how tall should they be? And what color eyes should they have? And what color hair? And how should they wear their hair? And how should they dress? And, you know, and if it's a girl, what kind of perfume would you like for her to wear? And how would you like for her to dress? And what kind of personality would you like for her to have? And you just imagine her right down to the last detail, then ask yourself this question. If that person were here right now, if she were standing right beside me, would she want to have a relationship with me? And the answer is no. You've been expending your energy in the wrong place. So that's the trick. The trick is to be the right person and not find the right person. And so that's what we were interested in becoming. And so we looked around among our friends and we found out, first of all, that you know, life within a relationship, like everywhere else, life is a matter of action. You know, thoughts are cute, but life is a matter of action. And if you don't like the way your life is, then you have to change your actions. You know, as my friend Francine says, if you want self-esteem, you can go around mouthing all the affirmations you want to. You know, but if you want self-esteem, you have to do esteemable things. thinking esteemable thoughts won't get it. If you want respect, you must be respectable. You know, trying to act as respectable won't do it. And if you want love, you must, alas, be lovable. There's a guy about a few thousand years ago that named Socrates, and he said, "You are what you repeatedly do." Excellence, then, is not an act, but a habit. So the first part of that really, I think, says it all. You are what you repeatedly do. You are not what you repeatedly think. You are what you do. If you steal things, you're a thief. If you say things that aren't true, you're a liar. I mean, alcoholics can justify all kinds of behavior, but the bottom line is, you know, you are what you do, not what you think. See, I always wanted to be judged. Paulie talked about it last night. I always wanted you to judge me by my intentions. I didn't want to be judged by my actions. I want you to judge me by my intentions. Gee, my intentions are great. another thing Paulie talked about some last night was baggage and the baggage that we bring into our relationships. I have a friend who says all emotional baggage must fit under the seat. And so the baggage that they were talking about that we bring into relationships is, of course, dysfunctional behavior from our family of origin. You know, my family was dysfunctional because I was in it. But, you know, some of us have come from some pretty dysfunctional families, and we bring those defense mechanisms with us when we come into a relationship and when we come into alcoholics, and, you know, and things trigger those defenses, and boy, they go up quick. And you have to learn to get by those and to get around those and get beyond the stage where you think it's necessary that you have those because they're destructive. But there's also functional behavior from a family of origin. And this has to do with your taste or preference in food or the way it's prepared. You know, women don't like to hear that your mother made it better, for example. It's, you know, it's the way we do things, you know. It's how to make how the bed should be made and when should it be made and how do you fold socks and should you, this shirt be folded and put in a drawer or hung on a hanger, and you know, things like that can cause disruptions and skirmishes. And a lot of times what we do with things like that, we found out, is that we don't say anything, but we do what I call putting brown stamps in the book, you know, just, and when the book's full one day, somebody will come in and say the wrong, something fairly innocent, but the wrong thing at that moment, and you cash in the whole book. And you know, so there's also some attitudes that, well, you know, I mean, you have to be careful. Some things can just be a real irritant, you know, like I like for the toilet paper to spin over the top, you know, and Susie, our daughter, and Polly put it on sometimes where it spins under the bottom and I have to change it. I mean, it's annoying. I mean, you'd think they'd learn by now, wouldn't you? There's also emotional and mental abuse that goes on a lot that is very destructive, and that's things like telling our mate that they're lazy or stupid or incompetent in some way doing that. You know, maybe not using such harsh terms, but telling people that they're lazy or that they're stupid or that they're incompetent or that there's something wrong with them. And there's also the problem of, you know, just the perpetual